I'm here today with Fleur Yuse, Director of Impact and Learning at the Peaceful Change Initiative, an NGO that works on change management and peace building in the South Caucasus region, as well as in Libya and Syria. Over the past decade, Fleur has worked on reconciliation and peace building in many parts of the world, from Liberia and Sudan to Georgia and Timor-Leste. She is currently mapping community-level peace resources in Syria to enhance the participation of communities in Syrian peace processes. Fleur, community-based approaches to security and peace building are increasingly recognized as important for stability and sustainable peace. What do local peace building activities bring that may be lacking in national and international processes?
I think the first thing that community-based approaches to peace building bring is that they enable the peace processes to really respond to the needs of people who have been at the front of the conflict. What we often see in modern conflicts is that it's not just a conflict between a state party and a rebel group or between two rebel groups. Often there are multiple conflicts taking place actually within a conflict. And so if you have a process that just involves the sort of the key parties, the key fighting parties, you might get an agreement between those, but that agreement will not necessarily address all the other conflicts that are actually occurring on the ground, if you like. And so you do need community-based approaches to really address the multiple conflicts that are occurring. So that's one thing. The other thing is that often when you bring together in a kind of an official process, if you bring together the sort of the belligerent parties, their needs are not necessarily the same needs as communities. And whoever is at the negotiating table is not necessarily particularly representative of communities. And so it's very important to have some form of process that can enable communities' needs to be heard and communities to have a voice so that the overall peace process is responsive to those needs. And we've seen some very clear examples of that in the work that the Peaceful Change Initiative has been doing, for example, in Libya, where when you talk about security at sort of the governmental level, that is interpreted as state security. Whereas if you talk about security, and solutions to state security seem very difficult to find in the current environment in Libya. But if you're talking at the community level, when people are talking about security, they're talking about sort of their human security, sort of everyday security issues. And that is actually possible to find solutions to on a case-by-case basis. And so you can actually, if you're working at the community level, you can actually start doing some really concrete work on security issues that make a big difference to people's everyday lives and that ultimately actually start shifting the overall security picture in the state, within the state, and therefore create more room for addressing sort of the national security issues.
In addition then to this sort of tidal shift that you're describing of bringing these actors together in local communities to address the diverse conflicts and this having an impact on overall security, how are these local peace and security initiatives best linked to national or even international processes? How can community-driven efforts yield broader political change? And do we need better mechanisms to make that happen?
I think there's no particular one way of linking communities to political processes that will work in every single country. At the moment in Syria, the Peaceful Change Initiative, together with our partner CCSDS, we're trying to map in 9 provinces what are the relationships, what are the mechanisms, what are the processes that are in place and that can be used and strengthened for ensuring that at the community level, there is some way of having a consultation with people who are involved in sort of in political processes. And what we are seeing is that that architecture is just very weak or not in place at all and needs to be built from scratch. And that's very much about building faith in institutions and organizations. It's about creating or building new ways of being in dialogue with each other. It's about changing people's perceptions of what their roles are when they're in leadership roles, whether at the very, very grassroots levels of whether they're in working in civil society or whether they're working in a political party. So it's very much a process, I think, creating those feedback loops between communities, civil society, and then the sort of political actors.
Keeping in mind, as you said, that every country and community is different, are there any cross-cutting issues in local communities in transition that we might not expect in our work here at UN headquarters?
I think a cross-cutting theme for communities that are experiencing large-scale violence in their daily lives is security, just the need for security, for the violence to stop. That's across the board, and then some kind of transition to stability, to democracy, to justice, human rights, and so on. That is across the board. What we're also seeing, I think, very much in Syria and also in our work in Libya is, unfortunately, a real lack of trust at the community level of international processes and of processes that are led by the civil society that is in exile or is external to the setting. That's a very common theme that's coming out. Another common theme is we want to do it ourselves and we want to do it in our own way. And then for me, a common theme that I've seen in so many places, no matter how desperate and dire the situation looks, is a real capacity for imagination that people have to keep on hoping, to keep on working for a better future, which is deeply, deeply inspirational.
As you've just said, communities want to build peace their own way. Where does that leave the UN and other international actors who are engaged in peace building?
Like I said before, there is this tendency towards distrust of the international community and this sense of we want to do it our own way and on our terms. At the same time, what I've also experienced is that many actors at the community level feel a little bit stuck. They know what they want to reach out. They know that they want to be, for example, in dialogue with the other side, if you like. But they don't know how. And then they kind of reach out. And I think in those situations, the international community, NGOs, the UN and so forth, can play a very useful role in just providing a space for people in conflict to have a conversation with each other. And if they request, we need to learn more about this or we need to learn more about that, then I think there's also a role that people in the international community can play in sharing in international expertise learned from many, many different countries and in many, many different settings. So I think that is a very, very useful role that we can play as long as it's a role that is developed in consultation with people who are going through conflict. And then I think a real challenge, certainly this has been a personal challenge for me, and I imagine that it's replicated within different organizations, is that sometimes people in conflict arrive at solutions that seem very strange to me. I've worked a lot, for example, in Liberia on reconciliation, and also in Darfur on local level reconciliation. And some of the solutions that different groups came up with in their reconciliation processes seemed very antithetical to my ideas of what reconciliation should look like. But I think that the sort of the reflection that I went through is that these solutions make sense at a local level. And because they make sense at a local level, they are probably more likely to hold and more likely to be respected and implemented than solutions that I could have offered that were textbook, this is what the sort of the processes of reconciliation are and should be. So it's about leaving space, I think, for local imagination.
Fleur, thanks for speaking with us today in the Global Observatory.